Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know, the Federal Reserve, they're trying, you guys. They really are.
So we'll continue to do the best we can.
To taper or not to taper, that was the question from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 18th of September, and this is the Marketplace podcast for said date, or as those of us in the business press have taken to thinking of it, it's Taper Day. No, not very poetic, but then again, the machinations of the central bank rarely are. The Federal Open Market Committee has been meeting the past couple of days to talk interest rates. They wrapped up this afternoon with, it must be said, something of a bombshell. There will be no taper today. That is, no imminent reduction of the Fed's big bond buying program to keep interest rates low. Heidi Moore from The Guardian is here to help make sense of it all. Hey, Heidi.
Hey, Kai.
So no taper. Is this courage, cowardice? Why did they not do this, the thing that we were all expecting?
This is courage. It's not going to play that way in the stock markets, but this is the Federal Reserve confronting the reality of the economy and saying it would be madness to start pulling out stimulus now, when unemployment is not doing so well, when personal incomes are falling, and when the housing recovery looks soft.
Okay, wait a second. But this is the Fed saying economy's not really strong, but the stock markets love this today. The Dow's like up 100 and something.
Yeah. You know, we've used that metaphor before of the quantitative easing stimulus being something like drugs and the market being like a meth addict. And so you can
A little Breaking Bad here on Marketplace.
It's all very topical. So you can think of the market basically saying, yay, more drugs. We are going to keep getting more drugs. Because if there has been one thing that quantitative easing has done well, it's been to boost the stock market and to a certain extent, the bond market.
Let's play this forward a little bit into the month of October when we have Washington debating debt limits. There's a budget thing that's going to happen. There's all kinds of big problems coming up in what the chairman said today was fiscal policy. And point of fact, Bernanke said today, Congress is a downside risk.
That's absolutely right. They're threatening gridlock in terms of the debt ceiling, which is coming in just a few months. So it's that same fight we had in 2011, 2012, and again in 2013. And what we know is that if Congress gets ugly enough about it, they could tank the economy. They could take this thing to the brink. And so Ben Bernanke is stepping in and saying, it's going to be a rough fall. We are going to do the only thing we can do, which is to keep the stimulus going.
Give me the bottom line here. This is Bernanke saying pretty much officially, you know what, the economy is not doing as well as we thought it was. Sorry.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And that's really sobering. He did cushion his thoughts in some positive words, because it would be disastrous for the chairman of the Federal Reserve to say that straight out. But in his indications in the press conference, everything he suggested was that the economy is not doing well and he does not feel comfortable leaving it to fend on its own.
How much do you suppose, just to look in the mirror for a minute, the business press hyped this whole taper thing?
Guilty as charged.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a really interesting lesson on how, in the end, nobody knows anything.
There you go. Heidi Moore from The Guardian. Thanks, Heidi.
Thank you, Kai.
All you got to do if you want an update on Wall Street is whisper low interest rates. Traders love them. Some quantitative easing today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Walgreens said today that come next year, it's going to get rid of its company-backed health plan. Instead, it'll send its 160,000 workers to private exchanges, not the government ones established under Obamacare, but private exchanges where those employees can pick from a stack of plans offered by different insurance companies. Walgreens will pay part of the premium. And it sounds empowering, consumer choice and all that. But when it comes to confusing, health insurance, as we all know, is about as confusing as it gets. So maybe the power of choice isn't all that, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
So I'm stepping into my local Walgreens and heading to the antacid section. There are easily 5-10 choices for any given treatment.
Walgreens workers may soon be in need of antacids themselves. Used to be they had just 2 insurance plans to pick from. On the exchange, says spokesman Michael Polzine,
each carrier will offer 5 different levels of plans to choose from.
Bronze, Bronze Plus, Silver, Gold, Platinum, High Deductible, Low Deductible, different premiums, copays, and doctor panels.
Could give you as many as 25 different options.
It's the king of all nightmare decisions. It's not necessarily rationally so. It's emotionally so.
Kit Yarrow studies consumer psychology at Golden Gate University.
People have a really tough time, I think, anticipating their future needs.
Will you need routine checkups or cancer treatment in the coming year? Will the cheapest, most limited plan give you access to enough good doctors? Psychologist Barry Schwartz at Swarthmore College wrote a book about the new consumer marketplace, The Paradox of Choice.
What economists would say is that more options has to be better because if you're not interested, you can ignore them. But what research shows is that when you do that, it paralyzes people and they don't choose at all. And here's what this will certainly happen. When you give them too many options, they make worse decisions.
Walgreens says the exchange administrator will help employees sort through the different plans, and having more choices may well save some employees money. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The CEO of Starbucks, Howard Schultz, dipped a toe into controversial waters today. He said the company will ask customers to leave their guns behind when they enter Starbucks stores. Until now, Starbucks had followed local gun laws, permitting patrons in open carry states where openly carrying a firearm is legal to keep their guns on them when they pop in for a latte. Marketplace's Noel King has that story.
In an open letter online, Schultz hints that the last straw was Starbucks Appreciation Day in August. Gun rights activists rallied at Starbucks stores to thank the company for its permissive approach to gun carriage. Schultz says he doesn't want those events in his stores. Still, he's not banning guns. The letter says he is respectfully requesting customers leave their guns behind.
You know, the way he billed it was, it doesn't fit in with the Starbucks experience, which, I mean, you know, give me a break. Then why don't you tell people not to bring guns into the store?
Paul Argenti of Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business has followed Starbucks for years. He thinks Schultz is equivocating.
If I were a gun owner, I'd say, okay, make me put the gun away.
Argenti says he isn't rooting for that kind of showdown, but if guns aren't banned, activists will continue to rally. Schultz has said that Starbucks employees won't confront armed customers. Stores won't post signs saying that guns are unwelcome. And if the hundreds of comments on the company's website are any indication, some customers are ticked off. So why do it?
Howard Schultz himself is passionate about America and protecting the employees in the stores.
Paul Williams is with Idea Sandbox, a marketing firm. And full disclosure, Starbucks was a client of his. He says Starbucks has a history of courting controversy. Remember when it first emerged on the caffeine scene?
Most of the coffee in America was a lighter taste, and Starbucks sort of put their mark in the market by offering something that was roasted and darker than normal, and that polarized people.
The stakes are higher this time, but company watchers like Paul Williams don't expect Starbucks to take a huge hit. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
There are elections in Germany this weekend, Europe's biggest and most powerful economy going away. Chancellor Angela Merkel seems to be a shoo-in on the heels of reasonable growth and fairly low unemployment. But the German economy is not entirely without its problems. For the first time in more than 60 years, a big German car factory is about to close. General Motors is shutting down its Opel plant in the industrial northwest part of that country. So in the first of a 3-part series on Germany and its economy, Stephen Beard reports now from the city of Bochum.
Perhaps it's because this city was once a real locomotive of the German economy that Bochum's favourite musical is about trains. Starlight Express, with actors on roller skates portraying toy trains. It's been running in this city for 25 years, the world's longest-running musical production. But now Bochum is earning a more dubious distinction.
We are very angry about it, and we don't agree at the closure Local worker Christoph Schweitzer says when the curtain comes down on the GM Opel plant here next year, it'll be the first major car factory to close in Germany since the Second World War, and it will impoverish the city.
A great number of people will become poor, not only the General Motors workers, but people indirectly connected with General Motors plant. Unemployment will rise, small shops will close, will be a great disaster.
At a small rally in the city centre, some of the 3,500 Opel workers who lose their jobs listen to this protest song. They can't take away our right to fight. Milan Sommer is a 23-year-old trainee at the plant. He's afraid that with unemployment already above 10%, this industrial city faces ruin.
Look at Detroit. It is what could happen to our city here. Detroit is a warning for Bochum.
No such pessimism here in City Hall. The building resonates with pride in this region's heyday as the heartland of heavy industry. Its bells were cast in Bochum steel, like thousands of bells around the world. But spokesman Tim Fröhlich says the city's been forging a non-industrial future, and it won't be devastated by the GM Opel closure.
Bochum will not become a second Detroit. The closure will affect our economy, but not to a threatening extent.
The city has diversified into healthcare, internet security and education. Bochum has 7 universities with 50,000 students. And with a planetarium, a zoo and dozens of restaurants and bars, it has incredibly morphed into a tourist centre. Mario Schievelbein, the tourism chief, says Starlight Express has been the engine pulling the city out of trouble.
14 million people saw this beautiful musical. I'm pretty sure there are a couple of more million people want to see Starlight Express, and we are very thankful that we do have such a bonus for our city.
But hitching a ride on a foreign musical is hardly a substitute for making cars. The Opel closure is a blow, a dent in Germany's image as one of the world's top car manufacturers. Or is it?
Well, in Germany, it's not perceived as a blow in general to the German car industries. It's perceived rather as a failure of Opel.
And its American parent, GM. Economist Gustav Horn says Opel failed to follow the example of much of the German car industry, which concentrated its export effort in high-growth markets, China, Brazil, Mexico, Indonesia.
Opel is focusing strongly on Europe, especially the euro area. And since things are pretty bad in the euro area, exports of Opel certainly were damaged severely by the euro crisis.
It will come as little consolation to Bochum that the eurozone as a whole has now pulled out of recession, thanks to exports to the rest of the world. In Bochum, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
We are all pawns. We are all part of helping the Bordeaux chateau owners get as much money as possible.
The business behind Bordeaux. But first, let's do the numbers. So listen, you remember August when the Dow Industrials lost nearly 900 points with investors worried about the Fed stimulus and Syria? As of today, all those points are back and more. The Dow and the S&P both hit new record highs. Today, the Dow added to its winning streak, gained 147 points, nearly 1%, finished at 15,676. The Nasdaq up 37 points, 1%, 3783. At the bell, the S&P 500 climbed 20 points, 1.2%, ended at 1725. The biggest winners, as you'd expect, from the prospect of lower interest rates for longer, home builders. KB Home jumped 8.2%. Today, D.R. Horton added 7%, Lennar 6.5%. Bond prices jumped. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.69%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. A House Foreign Affairs subcommittee discusses the Syrian refugee crisis. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for August. and you've probably used it to soften a comment or two in your digital messages. The emoticon was introduced on September 19, 1982. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's a new report out today on food waste. Not how much of it there is, but rather how much money we lose when we toss food that's past its sell-by date. There are those for whom those dates are hard and fast rules, and there are others for whom those rules are merely guidelines. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Wander into your local grocery store and you'll find food stamped with all kinds of dates. The sell-by date is for the store, for stock rotation. The use-by date is for us consumers, but it just tells us when a product is at its peak. We don't realize we can eat stuff after the use-by date and not get sick. Dana Gunders is a food scientist at the Natural Resources Defense Council, which released today's report.
The vast majority of Americans are confused and throwing away food prematurely.
Gunders estimates that Americans throw out up to $450 of perfectly good food every year. She says manufacturers are a bit too conservative with their use-by dates. They want you to get just the right amount of crunch from that potato chip. David Fikes is with the Food Marketing Institute, a trade group for stores and manufacturers. He says, look, manufacturers are just protecting their brands. And it's not like they want you to throw stuff away, so you have to go out and buy more.
Who wants to produce something only to have it pitched?
Right now, there's no federal standard on food labeling, just a patchwork of state and local rules. Michael Dunn teaches food science at Brigham Young University. He says things might be easier for manufacturers if the Fed stepped in.
It's always nice to have uniformity so that you can distribute broadly without worrying about individual state and local regulations.
But there's a catch. If manufacturers had to do a lot of retooling to comply with new federal rules, they'd pass the costs on to consumers. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
In my hotel room here in Atlanta this week, as in most hotel rooms everywhere nowadays, there are those little signs about the hotel being green and how we, the traveling public, can help by reusing our towels every day. You would guess correctly that that saves hotels a lot of money, but it also helps get them new business, big business too. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Walk into the Aria Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas. You'll feel the cool rush of the air conditioning. You'll see the flash, hear the jangle of the slot machines. You're not going to notice all the ways the space has been designed to use less energy. Except one. If you stay the night, you'll have to ask for clean towels. Throwing them on the floor doesn't count here. Cindy Ortega is the Chief Sustainability Officer for MGM Resorts, which owns Aria.
We say, if you want your towels washed every day, we'll definitely do it. Just let us know. But other than that, we're going to hang the towel up and make it nice for you, and we're not going to wash it every single night for you.
But don't most of us, secretly or not so secretly, want clean towels? At the end of the day, are hotels really gaining that much by not just giving me a dry, fluffy towel to wrap up in? Turns out the answer is yes. Companies save money with sustainability measures, but going green can also get them business. At Aria, about a third of the hotel's room revenue comes from conferences and meetings. And before businesses book the space, they've got questions. A lot of questions.
Companies like IBM and other big companies, they give us a whole survey that might be 2, 3, 4 pages long saying, not just do you recycle, what do you recycle? Do you recycle batteries? You know, not just the traditional paper and aluminum and so on. So it's a very sophisticated questionnaire.
Turns out IBM asks every supplier it works with for an environmental plan, from MGM to the company that makes circuit boards.
Oh my goodness, IBM has many suppliers.
Wayne Balta is IBM's VP of Corporate Environmental Affairs.
We have also said to them that we'd like them to cascade it down to their own first-tier suppliers. So in that way, the expectation and the ethic gets further extended in the supply chain.
So IBM encourages MGM. MGM encourages its vendors. And more businesses feel pressure to go green. According to the Boston Consulting Group, about 70% of large companies require their supply chain partners to sign up for certain sustainability practices. That's a lot of businesses driving other businesses, with more impact than any of us individual shoppers have.
Howard Connell is the director of the Center for Business Strategies for Sustainability at Georgia Tech. Say, for example, that you need paper towels. You go to the grocery store.
You go up to the shelf, look at what product you want, and you grab it and you go. Most people don't have time to worry about what are the sustainability implications of the choices that I'm making.
But if you're a business, you might be buying $1 million worth of paper towels.
The discussion that occurs around that purchase is much more involved.
There are those detailed questionnaires. There are RFPs. Businesses buy more, and they often buy more thoughtfully. Connell says companies don't get contracts just because they have sustainability plans, but it can help. Which brings us back to those hotel towels and all those other sustainability initiatives. Maybe you like them, maybe you don't, maybe you don't notice. But big business is paying attention, and they often get what they want. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Imagine the best bottle of wine you can think of. Now imagine how much you'd pay for it. If you're a serious enophile, you'd best be thinking four or maybe even five digits, especially for red wines from Bordeaux, the vineyards in the southwest of France, considered by many to be the best in the world.
And the auctioneer was going like 300,000, 500,000, 700,000. Then suddenly I just raised my paddle. I said 1.5 million.
Warwick Ross is one of the producers of a new documentary about the global wine economy and the way it is changing. It's called Red Obsession. Warwick, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Seems to me that wine is maybe the ultimate supply-demand thing, because once a 1945 Lafitte is bottled, man, there ain't no more.
There ain't no more. Limited supply. Yes, I think that's right. The really extraordinary vintages are held by collectors all over the world, and there are fewer and fewer of them as the years go on, of course, because people are drinking them.
And as people drink them and buy them, and as this movie talks about, trade them, inflation in the wine market is extreme.
Yes, the top level wines of Bordeaux went up something like 1,000% in about 5-6 years, which is pretty extraordinary by anybody's markers. And in fact, wine has outperformed the stock markets, gold, FTSE, since something like 1982.
And so we get to the point of this film, which is, why is that happening?
Yeah, good question. I think I think it's a commodity. There's two things that are happening. One, you've got the people that are buying these wines to drink them. And that's what you'd expect to happen. But wine is also turning into a commodity. And once wine reached these extraordinary levels, and I mean something like $1,000 a bottle, and even higher than that, of course, they've become too valuable to drink.
That's a great phrase. Let's play that clip from the film. I love this. Too valuable to drink, too big to fail. We got it all.
In the past 10 years, prices of the top Bordeaux wines have risen by more than 1,000%. As the price of these wines continues to escalate, the inevitable has happened. They've become too valuable to drink.
Russell Crowe, of course, doing the voiceover there, which is cool. I love
right.
the ominous music.
Yeah.
What then is the average tippler to do if he wants just a little bit of red wine?
Well, I think you can find fabulous wines for $20 or $30, quite frankly. I don't think you need to spend $5,000 for a Lafitte Rothschild. But if you feel inclined and you've got the cash, then it's a pretty extraordinary experience.
The second half of this film sees you in Hong Kong with
right.
the Hong Kong wine auctions and also on the mainland in Shanghai and Beijing.
Yeah.
Talk to me for a second about the role of the Chinese in the global wine market, because mm-hmm. that's kind of where this all comes down.
Yeah, well, 5 or 10 years ago, they didn't really exist in the global wine market. They've discovered wine in a major way, particularly in the last 5 years, and that's where some of these major collectors have really been making themselves felt. They collect the finest wines of Bordeaux. Bordeaux, they see Bordeaux as the best wine in the world. It has the romance, it has the history, it has these glamorous chateaus. And Bordeaux itself has become a brand. And the Chinese, of course, are very brand-oriented, as everybody knows in the world. They want, you know, Nike, Louis Vuitton, Hermes, and now Bordeaux as well.
Who's making the money?
Yeah, well, the Chateau owners would like to be making the money.
Yeah.
There are so many middlemen in the wine business. The Chateau sells to something called a courtier. The courtier sells to the négociant. The négociant sells to the merchant.
Oh,
the merchant
Lord.
Sells to you. So,
wow.
Yeah, there's a lot of markup in wine. But the Chateaus, I have to say, those top-level Chateaus that push the prices of the 2010 vintage to an all-time historic high of something like, you know, $2,000 a bottle at retail, they are making a lot of money.
Have you had any of them, by the way, the 2010s?
Yeah, we were forced to drink these wines during the course of filming.
It's on that expense budget somewhere that the accountants are still trying to figure out.
Yeah, yeah.
That's great. Warwick Ross, the film is called The Red Obsession. He is the producer, co-director, and co-writer on this thing. Thanks much for coming in.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You can listen to an extended version of that interview at marketplace.org and find out where to watch that film.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which the internet meme known as Grumpy Cat pretty much jumps the shark. You've seen it, I'm sure. Pithy sayings plastered all over a feline face that is indeed grumpy. Anyway, Grumpy Cat now has a major endorsement deal. It is going to be, and I am not making this up, the spokescat for Friskies. It's just the latest in quite a run for a cat. A movie deal, a New York Times bestseller, merchandise as well. We, in fact, had the cat's manager on the show a couple of months ago. You can check it out at marketplace.org. And yes, this is indeed the part of the broadcast where we begin to despair for the future of humanity. All right, we're done. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineer the program for us. Thanks also today to the staff here at Georgia Public Broadcasting. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back home tomorrow in Los Angeles. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.